Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present author and columnist Norman Solomon, who assesses the congressional vote which authorizes President Bush to prosecute a war against Iraq, with or without support from the United Nations. Luis Gomez, Andean bureau chief with Narco News, who looks ahead to the October 27th Brazilian runoff presidential election, where the Progressive Workers' Party candidate, Luis Inácio Lula da Silva, is expected to win. And Robert Watson, former head of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, who discusses the environmental damage being triggered by unchecked global warming. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The news magazine In These Times reports that oil exploiters have their eyes on the untapped oil fields in Kirkuk and Mosul in northern Iraq, currently under the protection of no-fly zones. The great oil game in Kirkuk started in 1918 when the oil-hungry British took over the region from the crumbling Ottoman Empire. Ever since, the Turkish government has routinely raised the issue of its lost territories. The Kirkuk oil field is now valued at $10 billion. In late August, the Turkish defense minister again referred to northern Iraq as historic Turkish land. Other top Turkish leaders have talked about the number of ethnic Turks in northern Iraq as a pretext for preventing the establishment of a Kurdish state in northern Iraq. Ahmed Kalabini of the American-backed Iraqi National Congress has stated that once Saddam Hussein is deposed, presumably by American troops, the major American oil interests like Halliburton, ExxonMobil, and Chevron Texaco may get access to Iraqi oil reserves, the second largest after Saudi Arabia. Yet a land grab by Turkey could create more unrest. The millions of Kurds in the region would resist such a move. In the event of ethnic warfare over Kirkuk, a spokesman for the American Kurdish Information Network warned, Turkey will have to say goodbye to Iraq. 20 years ago, in September 1982, Christian phalangist militiamen invaded the Sabra and Shatila refugee camps in Beirut and raped and killed nearly 3,000 Palestinian civilians. According to The Nation magazine, no one was ever put on trial for the massacre. But an Israeli inquiry laid personal responsibility for the atrocity at the feet of Ariel Sharon, then the Israeli defense minister. It was Sharon who ordered the Israeli army to invade Lebanon and surrounded the refugee camps. The commission report damaged Sharon's political career, but the old warrior made a political comeback by convincing then-Labor Prime Minister Ehud Barak to allow Sharon to visit Haram al-Sharif, one of Islam's most holy sites in East Jerusalem. The incident sparked the Second Intifada, and Sharon was elected prime minister 6 months later. In June 2001, Palestinian plaintiffs brought a lawsuit against Sharon and others in Belgian courts alleging war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide for the bloody Sabra and Shatila massacres. Early in 2002, phalangist militia leader Eli Hobika, whose troops carried out the massacre, promised to go to Belgium and testify. Only days later, he was killed by a car bomb. Two other Lebanese with direct knowledge of the massacre were also assassinated, and in June, a Belgian appeals court threw out the case. For the first time this year, Green Party candidates are using public financing to appeal to mainstream voters. In Maine, anti-clear-cutting activist Jonathan Carter, the Green Party candidate for governor, has taken in $900,000 in public funds after qualifying under the state's clean election law. Other Green Party candidates are also securing public financing. Ken Pentel, a Minnesota Green Party candidate running for governor, is expected to receive $250,000 in matching funds for the fall election. Still, it is Carter in Maine who is making the most waves. A Green candidate in 1994, Carter is now buying primetime radio and TV commercials that are reaching many voters in the mostly rural state. National Green Party spokeswoman Nancy Allen told E! The Environmental magazine, "We now have high expectations of ourselves. We never had such ease in getting press coverage. They're falling all over themselves." Bowdoin College professor John Resenbrink says the media is just following the money and doesn't care about the message or grassroots organizing, but they do care about the bottom line. Meanwhile, many Democrats are still bitter at Ralph Nader, the 2000 Green presidential candidate, for throwing the election to George W. Bush. The Greens reply by saying the two-party system is the real spoiler and that they are just offering more alternatives to the status quo. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Jeff Wignall.
After several days of debate, which included impassioned pleas by Senator Robert Byrd to resist the march to war, Congress voted by a sizable majority to give President Bush unrestricted authority to launch an attack against Iraq and overthrow the government of Saddam Hussein. Just before the House and Senate debate got underway, CIA Director George Tenet issued a letter which undermined many of the White House claims that Saddam Hussein poses an imminent threat to the U.S. The letter addressed to Congress stated that Iraq was not likely to mount terrorist attacks with weapons of mass destruction unless faced with a U.S.-led attack. While the Bush administration focused its attention on gaining support for a war against Baghdad, terrorist attacks attributed to the al-Qaeda network were reported across the globe. The killing of a U.S. Marine in Kuwait, an attack on a French tanker off the coast of Yemen, and the deadly bombing of a nightclub in Bali, Indonesia, resulting in more than 180 fatalities, all seem to point to a pattern of renewed activity by the group dispersed from its sanctuary in Afghanistan 1 year ago. Before the congressional vote, the Institute for Public Accuracy, a group which works to gain access for dissenting points of view in corporate media, organized a fact-finding delegation to Iraq in mid-September. The delegation included U.S. Representative Nick Rahal, Democrat of West Virginia, former South Dakota Senator James Aberesk, Dr. James Jennings of Conscience International, and syndicated columnist Norman Solomon, who serves as the executive director of the Institute for Public Accuracy. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Norman Solomon, who assesses the congressional green light for war with Iraq and describes what he saw and heard during his recent trip to Baghdad.
You know, I think with all the historic differences, there still is a lot of similarity to the Gulf of Tonkin resolution back in August of 1964, and really a kind of a blank check atmosphere. It's become a bit of a cliche, but it's very true. This is a blank check that I think will be redeemed, so to speak, with a lot of blood, and it's something that got significant opposition, I think, from more than 100 members of Congress, 130 or so in the House, not so many in the Senate. About a quarter of the Senate voting no. But this is, I think, a very sinister development by any measure.
What are your biggest fears about what might happen in the coming months, given the congressional green light for a war with Iraq, with or without United Nations authority?
Well, one of my biggest fears is that the United Nations authority is going to be manipulated and kind of hijacked. We have the precedent of the Gulf War back in early 1991, and there are a lot of carrots and sticks that can be brandished and used by the U.S. government, and certainly this Bush administration is very intent on doing so. I think that people who were concerned about this war in the summer and early fall of this year really set some traps for themselves or bought into them. You know, if you go back and look at just the nonsense that was said about Dick Armey and Colin Powell and Chuck Hagel, well, they all support this war. And the media frame was set up to try to scam people into believing that these supposed opponents of going to war somehow represented the outward pole of opposition. The opposition was tactical. You know, we have to get our ducks lined up. We don't know if we'll have the allies. Don't go without the United Nations. You even read in the Nation magazine people saying, you know, we can't have a go-it-alone policy. The point is, whether you have allies or not, if the war is wrong, then you have to oppose the war. And we're in a situation now where the U.S. government has shown that it can strong-arm out of the executive branch the Congress into giving a green light. They're in the process, as we speak, of strong-arming the U.N. Security Council into giving a green light. And so sooner or later, and I think it has to be sooner, people need to stand their ground and say, look, this war is wrong as a scenario, as a plan, whether it has allies and Security Council approval and congressional approval or not.
Could you talk about the most important things that you saw and heard while you were in Baghdad on your trip there?
Well, to me, it was really personally stunning to look out over the city of Baghdad, which has 5 or 6 million people in it, and to see it as a normal, large metropolis. And I felt like I was at the scene of a crime before the crime had been committed, and that would be a crime against humanity, which would be to launch missiles into this densely populated urban area. It was also really clear to me from being at meetings with Tariq Aziz and Congressman Ray Hall and former Senator James Aberesk, and also Jim Jennings, the president of Conscience International, a human rights humanitarian aid group, that there is value in dialogue with the Iraqi government officials, that we learn things in that process, that it's possible to begin to problem solve and find some potential alternatives to massive killing and bloodshed and long-term massacres of people, not only through warfare, but through its inevitable aftermath. And quite often, we're encouraged to believe that there's simply no point in talking to Iraqi officials. I think the truth is very different. Meanwhile, it's clearly a police state. Iraq is a very repressive government. And at the same time, you know, the U.S. has relations with many regimes around the world and engages in dialogue. It's quite ironic that here in October of 2002, the U.S. is in talks with North Korea, which is supposedly part of this axis of evil, and yet the U.S. is planning to bomb another part of that axis with the argument that there's no point in engaging in any kind of diplomacy with them.
Norman, can you give us some of your observations about what the media role has been in this lead-up to a possible future war with Iraq?
I think largely the news media have framed the debate as being whatever debate is most prominent in elite circles, and that is to say, you know, whatever Joseph Biden and Joseph Lieberman and President Bush have to say, that's kind of the range of debate. I think that's ridiculous. There are some anti-war congressional voices that have gotten some airtime. Some Republican dissent earlier in the summer got a lot of prominence, but that's been largely, I think, the media framework. At the same time, there is some acknowledgement of a growing anti-war movement, but none of the coverage of an anti-war movement, such as it is right now, can really balance out just the overwhelming media reliance on official sources and the willingness to allow and enable those in powerful positions to really largely set the parameters of debate. You know, I think it all boils down to whatever stage we're in, people at the grassroots, whether through independent media outlets and organizing and protests and research and sharing information and community activism, this all needs to happen to utilize whatever space exists, and we're going to have to go with the flow and keep pushing at every stage.
That was syndicated columnist and author Norman Solomon. Read his Media Beat column online at www.fair.org. In the first round of the Brazilian presidential election on October 6th, Workers' Party candidate Luiz Inácio da Silva won 46% of the vote, falling just short of the 51% he needed to avoid a runoff. In the final round of voting, scheduled for October 27th, da Silva, known as Lula to Brazilians, will face José Serra of the ruling Brazilian Social Democratic Party. Brazil's troubled economy contributed to the weak showing of Mr. Serra in the first round, where he received only 23% of the vote. Da Silva, once the head of the Metal Workers Union, led his party to gain the largest number of seats in Brazil's congressional lower house and picked up the endorsement of two first-round presidential candidates who together won 30% of the vote. While Lula is far ahead in public opinion polls, anxiety among the financial sector about the prospects of a Workers' Party government has, by many accounts, contributed to the steep devaluation of the Brazilian currency, the real. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Luiz Gomes, Andean bureau chief with the online publication Narco News, who reports from Sao Paulo on what may be the most important political contest this year. Gomes discusses Lula's prospects as the final round of voting approaches and what the world can expect from a Workers' Party government.
Last Friday, there was an inquiry about the votes for the 27th, and Lula got 58%. That means, if things go normally, he's going to be the next president of Brazil.
What kind of effect does the currency devaluation in Brazil have on the average voter? What is the message being sent by the banks and the speculators with the devaluation? Their fear of Lula becoming president is certainly palpable there, right?
You know, enterprise people and bank rulers, they think, they're almost sure Lula is going to win and the country is going to grow. There were a poll between them, and they're sure Lula is going to be the next president. So they don't have much problem with whom is going to be in Brasilia next February. Problem is, I think, the government's maneuvering to make some terrorism. The message to the people, I think, is, okay, if you're going to choose this worker, man, we will make you as hard as possible to reach the presidency. But I don't think people believe this is going to be for the next 6 years.
What is the major policy shift that you think we will see in Brazil if Lula is elected president?
Lula has promised to the people that the incomes are going to get down. If you have more, you got to pay more. But if you have nothing, you're not going to pay. And the second one, I think the major change, in fact, is they're going to redistribute the resources for people. And anything the government, any program of the government, of the next government of Lula, will be first for the people, for the poorest, especially on the favelas in Sao Paulo, in Rio, in Porto Alegre, the main cities with favelas, these poor neighborhoods, kind of ghettos.
Is that where Lula's support mainly comes from, the poor majority in Brazil?
Yes, but now you can see, like in Bolivia last July, you can see now a middle class voting for him. You can see large groups of intellectuals and artists voting for him. In fact, there are some of the best musicians here in Brazil voting for him since the last three elections. Sure, the majority of these people is a poor one.
Luis Gomes, what do you think the effect of Lula gaining the presidency in Brazil will have on the rest of Latin America? There's a lot of turmoil in terms of rejection in places like Bolivia and Argentina of the IMF, International Monetary Fund, and World Bank formula for recovery, economic recovery. You also have a situation in Venezuela that is quite tense. What net effect do you think Lula's presidency may have on Latin America?
This is going to be a change, not even in America, in Latin America. It's going to be a change in the world. This is one of the biggest countries in the world and the most important country in Latin America. Lula on the power will be a change on politics in the whole continent. Some people from the right here in Brazil are talking about an axis between Fidel Castro in Cuba, Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, and Lula in Brazil. But Lula himself has told he's not going to build an axis. He's going to work with his neighbors, that it means Bolivia, Argentina, Uruguay, Venezuela, Colombia, and Peru. He's going to be to work with them friendly. For example, in Bolivia, Evo Morales, the Cocalero leader, he is a very, very close friend to Lula. So he's awaiting because he is going to be reinforced. He's going to be politically more stronger than he was in the last elections. So he's awaiting really, really anxious to Lula win.
Luis Gomes, just a final question. How do you think Lula, if elected president of Brazil, will get along with Washington, with the Bush administration? And certainly one of the big issues that will be coming up in the year ahead is negotiations over the free trade area of the Americas, which Lula has spoken out strongly against.
This is going to be a hard negotiation. Lula has told in the last week he's not going to broke relations with Washington. Bad that these kind of relations, especially with the free trade, they have to be changed into another position. So Lula thinks he can negotiate with Washington in a plane of sovereignty and dignity. He was to be face-to-face with Bush and talk him like if they were equal people. Lula thinks that it will be a good thing if Latin American countries can negotiate with the United States in another more strong position.
That was Luis Gomez, Andean Bureau Chief with Narco News. Read Gomez's reports on the Brazilian election by visiting the online publication's website at www.narconews.com. Even the Bush administration has now acknowledged that human dependency on fossil fuels is causing global warming. President Bush's response is to say people should simply adjust to this new fact of life, rather than try to reverse the trend. But the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC, took a more proactive stance under the leadership of Robert Watson. Founded by the United Nations in 1988, the IPCC has issued three reports on climate change, each providing more conclusive evidence than the preceding one on the environmental damage attributable to climate change triggered by human technology. Robert Watson, a native Australian who is now a U.S. citizen, headed the IPCC when the group's third report was issued in 2001, and as head of the organization, made an urgent call to the nations of the world to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions. After the Bush administration withdrew U.S. support for his re-election this fall, Watson was defeated by the less aggressive Dr. Rajendra Pachauri of India, whom the White House actively supported. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Robert Watson about the environmental and social impacts of global warming, the roles of the industrialized and developing nations in the Kyoto Protocol to reduce greenhouse gases, and the Bush administration's rationale for withdrawing from the Kyoto Treaty.
The third report, indeed, has the most definitive statement on human-induced climate change. We noted that the Earth's climate is warming. We noted that we could not explain the observed warming on natural variability. And we stated that most of the observed warming for the past 50 years is indeed due to human activities. We also noted that most of the implications of the warming in the future will likely be our adverse effects on ecological systems, socioeconomic systems, and human health. Now, the process for choosing the chair is a democratic election of all governments, and indeed I was elected to be the chair for the third assessment report. Dr. Pachauri from India has been elected to be the chair for the fourth assessment report.
Very recently, both Russia and China have signed on to the Kyoto Protocol, which, as we're both well aware, and our audience is probably well aware, President Bush unsigned the U.S. from. Now that those two nations have signed on, do you think that would put more pressure on the U.S. to, in fact, agree to the Kyoto Protocol? And or do you think that it matters less that the U.S. is on board since these nations and many other nations now have signed on?
There's actually two categories of nations. One are the industrialized countries, and two are the developing countries. For the Kyoto Protocol to enter into force, it needs 55 countries to ratify, and it has to be 55% of the Annex 1 or industrial emissions. Russia and Canada have stated that they will indeed ratify the Kyoto Protocol, subject to approval by their parliaments. All of Europe and Japan and some other developed countries have already agreed to ratify. So if indeed the Russian government, or parliament in this case, were to ratify, and the Canadian, it will enter into force with or without the United States. China ratifying, along with India and other developing countries, is also a very important sign that they take climate change as a serious environmental issue. But it has no legal obligations on developing countries to take any actions to reduce their emissions. They have action plans they have to put together. They have the spirit of trying to limit their greenhouse gas emissions, but no legally binding obligations. The question about the United States is it's very important that the United States takes the climate change issue seriously and starts to reduce its emissions. In my opinion, India and China and other major developing countries who are increasing their use of energy and increasing their emissions, will not sign on to or agree to binding obligations on them without the United States already having taken action. So in my opinion, it is important for the United States to take actions to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions. Otherwise, India and China won't.
My understanding of what the Bush administration has said is that one of the main reasons that it has not agreed to sign is that it says that the developing countries aren't under any obligation. What you're saying right now is that the only way they would ever agree to any obligation is if the United States signs on.
President Bush has basically said that the Kyoto Protocol is flawed because it is neither fair nor effective. His main arguments for not ratifying Kyoto are threefold. One, he claims and states there are scientific uncertainties. The answer is yes, there are scientific uncertainties. But scientific uncertainties goes in two directions. We may be overestimating the impact of human activity or underestimating it. So in that uncertainty in itself is not a reason for inaction. And indeed we've seen that most of the rest of the industrialized world are taking action, recognizing there are still some remaining uncertainties. And indeed, many countries view that uncertainty itself may be the reason for action, because we're not sure exactly the implication. Secondly, President Bush has said there will be significant economic costs to the United States to ratify the Kyoto Protocol. Other developed countries don't view the cost to be exorbitant, and some very large multinational companies have actually demonstrated quite convincingly they can reduce emissions and actually make a profit. The third issue is indeed that it is not fair that developing countries will not have any obligations. I think this is an equity issue, and one has to think through the following. First, industrialized countries have put 80% of the greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, so 20% of the world's population has actually put 80% of the gases in. Secondly, the United States and Europe have become rich and developed by exploiting cheap energy. So do we have the right to say to China and India that they cannot exploit their energy resources? And third, developed countries such as Europe, Japan, the United States do have the institutional, technical and financial capability to take the first steps. So it's an issue of differentiated responsibilities. It is quite clear, and President Bush is quite correct in saying, that we can never stabilize the Earth's atmosphere or the greenhouse gas concentrations without all countries participating. So absolutely correct. It cannot effectively control climate without all of us taking part. The real question is, do we need the developed countries to take the first steps to strongly encourage developing countries to join with us in the second and third steps?
That was Robert Watson, former head of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, who now serves as chief scientist at the World Bank. To learn more about the IPCC, visit the panel's website at www.ipcc.ch. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756, or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, Jeff Wignall, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.